They settle on Tracy, which in Celtic means fierce or fighter. In this era, such characteristics are flaws. Girls should be sugar and spice and all things nice, according to the nursery rhyme. However, these attributes are awfully handy in adulthood. Despite being born in a developed country, one where girls are wanted, I learn early that vaginas cause problems. This is reinforced repeatedly over the next 5 decades, with the extra X of lesser value than the Y. To compensate for this deficit, I'm determined to be the good girl, ingratiatingly polite, in eternal apology for my gender. Which is not to say my parents are to blame. They're egalitarian and open-minded, scrupulous about avoiding sexist stereotypes. Mum and Dad, Marcia and Paul, fell in love over the phone talking about transport logistics. Romantic, I know. They're yin and yang. She's an effusive ex-model who dances on tables and stands on soapboxes. He's the shy son of Methodists who loves books and loathes crowds. Paul is a reservations clerk at Ansett in the golden age of air travel. He dons a leather jacket to ride a motor scooter to work. No helmet, of course. Might muck up your hair. Marcia is the first female courier driver for TNT. Thomas Nationwide Transport, not trinitrotoluene. That'd be a dangerous delivery. In the 1960s, the company advertised for pretty young female drivers to appeal to the men in dispatch departments. The Courier Mail reported on Mum's remarkable achievement with this line: "Who would have thought? Women can drive after all." This isn't an unusual attitude. In a letter to the editor of the Canberra Times during that decade, a reader bewails the timorous ditherers on the road, women drivers obviously clueless and inept. In the early days of driving, only wealthy women could afford it. Their feistiness and ability was admired. As car ownership spread to everyone after the war, motoring was reclaimed as a masculine pursuit. The less privileged women didn't have the social cachet of their predecessors with which to effectively dismiss these criticisms, Dr. Sean O'Connell writes in Eat My Dust, Early Women Motorists. Much of the criticism is disguised as humour. In 1965, Robin Adair writes in the Australian Women's Weekly about a survey into the Australian taxi industry, which recommends increasing the number of women drivers. Picture the operations of the all-female-staffed Chartreuse Cab Company. "Where are you, Car 34?" asks the radio controller. "Oh, I'm at the intersection of that yummy fur shop that's having a clearance on Peshkaniki muffs and that darling boutique where Car 64 picked up that positively dreamy hat." 4 years on, he begrudgingly endorses women behind the wheel. "I see that London underwriters have announced that women car drivers are better insurance risks than men. It follows that they must be, overall, better drivers. I won't argue about this." We live in a 2-bedroom timber house in Brighton, hemming the outskirts of Brisbane. Mum and Dad bought this tiny abode after a bomb went off near their flat in Normanby. Bikies, I believe. In contrast, this area is nice and quiet, home to a huge aged care facility. As a 3-year-old, I received the best birthday present ever, a baby sister. I asked for a bike, but a small human will suffice. Suzanne is as dark as I am fair, as quiet as I am confident, and as chubby as I am weedy. I write this because fat is a feminist issue. My sister spends much of her childhood being teased mercilessly. Few creatures are more maligned than an overweight female, because popular culture says our sole purpose is to act as eye candy. During the 1970s, children's fat camps are popular, accompanied by workshops in charm. There's even a Barbie book on dieting telling little girls, "Don't eat." Suze and I support each other through thick and thin. Sometimes we finish each other's sentences. Frankly, we're two halves of the same whole. It's an idyllic upbringing, scoffing potato scallops on the beach. "Screw you, Barbie." Catching yabbies in Bramble Bay.